is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, new word about a British hostage held by Islamic State militants in Syria. The importance of the media in fighting ISIS.
Violence breeds more violence. Repression will only create more radicalization and more underground movements.
Afghanistan's president visits China in his first official trip. And a ceremony is held marking the founding of Tibet Charity in India's Dharamsala. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Fighting continues in the northern Syrian town of Kobani, with the familiar sounds of jets flying overhead, signaling ongoing efforts to keep Islamic State militants from seizing the area from Kurdish forces. VOA correspondent Scott Bob is on the Syrian-Turkey border outside Kobani.
The fighting that we saw that was quite intense at times on Monday has quieted down. But what we've had on Tuesday today is at least four airstrikes, according to refugees and local residents across the border. These have been targeted towards the central part of the city, which is the contested part between the Islamic State fighters and the Kurdish militias.
And I understand there's new word about a British hostage, a fellow being held by ISIS.
Well, there was a video released by the Islamic State of a hostage that they had been holding for many, many months, showing him in Kobani and saying that the Islamic State controls the city. Kobani residents who are on this side of the border told me that, yes, it is Kobani, but it's East Kobani, which is under control of the Islamic State and is not disputed. And what they said, it did not prove, as was the claim, that the Islamic State controls all of the city. As far as we hear, the Kurdish militias still control at least half of the western part of the Kobani.
This might be good news in that he's still alive.
Yes, and he's also being used, it would be clear, that for their purposes of propaganda. He was dressed in civilian clothes as opposed to the orange prison guard that he appeared in earlier. And he's, of course, doing what he's told. It's an effort to use him for propaganda purposes, it would seem, and that's the way it is.
It's been a while since we've had one of those very disgusting beheadings. Is that a change in direction for ISIS?
It might be. What it is that they are down to just a handful of hostages, especially from Britain or the United States, having killed the others. And secondly, they may have decided that this was not the best publicity for them and what they're trying to achieve. It's impossible to verify this, but this does represent, with the latest video, a sort of a new tack of showing that, you know, a Western journalist saying that they are in control of the city.
What is the attitude there among the refugees today? Are they encouraged by this fighting?
There's sort of a gruesome, let's hold out, this is going to take a long time kind of attitude. It's interesting now, in one of the airstrikes, there's about several dozen of them, the refugees here on this hilltop, and there's cheering and applause, even though those airstrikes likely destroyed some of the homes of the people who were here. So it's a mixture of feeling of glad to have the assistance to their cause, but also ruining the destruction and the killing that's going on.
VOA correspondent Scott Bob on the Syrian-Turkey border outside Kobani. Monday on International Edition, we heard from Sahar Hamis, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland, about Islamic State militants converting young Muslims into followers. Today, VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy continues that conversation.
The so-called Islamic State is using social media to lure young Muslims to its ideology. How important is the role of the Arab media in creating a culture of democracy, pluralism, and inclusiveness that would fight back such hateful ideology?
Of course, the idea of having an open space of expression and an open platform in the media where people can talk and speak up and, you know, express their views and ideas is the only healthy way to overcome terrorism, radicalism, extremism, and violence. And that's what I'm hoping that the Arab regimes would understand, and that the rest of the world also, international powers and Western powers, would understand that under dictatorship, under repression, you don't really have true stability. Let's remember that many dictators, including Mubarak, were able to stay in power for decades under the claim or under the assumption that it's either they or, you know, they stay in power or there is chaos. So the idea of, you know, keep the dictator in power or in office because the alternative is going to be chaos and lack of stability, has not proven to be a very successful one. I think that we need more than ever before this kind of open platform where all the ideas are out there, a free marketplace of ideas, where people can freely express themselves. In my opinion, that's the best and only way to overcome violent extremism, because violence breeds more violence. Repression will only create more radicalization and more underground movements and more violence. It is never a solution. Opening up space for people to express themselves, not just as a safety valve to vent their anger or emotions, but to truly be inclusive and include everyone in the political scene and in the media arena, is the best and only way to fight violent extremism.
But what do you recommend in order for the Arab media to help fighting the ideology of evil versus good that ISIL is promoting?
Number one, to promote the idea of political inclusion that we have been talking about, that all the different trends or groups have to be included in the political process and have to find the space in the media. So they should not go along with the trend of suppressing some voices just because the regime in power is not happy about them or would like to conceal them or would like to stigmatize them and label them. Unfortunately, some media outlets are already colored with the political views of the regimes in power, and they're not willing to be inclusive, and that's a very dangerous process because exclusion, as we said before, will lead to repression and will lead to more violent extremism. Number two, the idea of clearing really the air in terms of what is Islam, bringing about true awareness of Islam and Muslims, their lifestyles, the values, the essence, the core values of the religion have to be clarified, not just locally or regionally, but most importantly, globally and internationally. Bringing truly informed scholars who don't only master the tenets of the faith, but also have the linguistic and cultural know-how and ability to express their views and their ideas to an international audience through using different languages and new media technologies. And that's very important because, as you mentioned correctly, ISIS or ISIL is really very advanced in terms of using YouTube videos and using the internet and social media in order to attract its followers. And therefore, the best way to counter that would be through the very same tools and the very same means, which is using new technologies, social media, new media, reaching out to young people in a language they understand, and addressing global public opinion to bring about the true and correct understanding and awareness of Islam.
Zahara Mees, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
A U.S. nurse quarantined for exposure to Ebola has been cleared for discharge as the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issues new guidelines for returning health workers. The CDC has called for health workers at the highest risk of infection to voluntarily quarantine themselves at home. However, the agency said most workers returning from West Africa would not need isolation and could be monitored by U.S. authorities. Meantime, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie announced that a nurse quarantined by state officials could finish her quarantine at home. Christine said on Twitter that nurse Kachi Hitchcocks does not have any symptoms of Ebola and may confine herself at home until her 21-day quarantine is complete. Hitchcocks returned Friday from a stint treating Ebola victims in West Africa. She became the first person quarantined under New Jersey's new policy, requiring healthcare workers returning from West Africa to be isolated for 21 days upon their return. Hitchcocks, who has tested negative for the virus, had threatened to challenge her quarantine in a lawsuit. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, is in West Africa assessing the region's Ebola response efforts. There are questions at the U.S. State Department daily press briefing about Power possibly being exposed to the disease. Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki.
She's not visiting any Ebola treatment units. They're observing all hand-washing protocols and doing temperature screenings multiple times a day.
Power's trip comes just as several U.S. states issued new quarantine rules for people returning from West Africa in response to fears that U.S. federal guidelines do not go far enough to contain an outbreak centered in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone that has infected 10,000 people. Saki said Ambassador Power and the people traveling with her are aware that they have to abide by the rules of the U.S. state in which they arrive when returning from West Africa.
Ambassador Power and the traveling party were obviously aware of the discussions of potential quarantines by state and local officials prior to departure and will, of course, be prepared to abide by requirements upon return. That said, they are also in close contact with the CDC, with medical experts, and are taking absolutely every precaution to stay safe and to avoid contracting the disease, a risk that pales in comparison to the risk we take if the international community does not take further action.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki. In addition to all the issues the Ebola crisis is causing in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and the rest of the region, there is a growing food crisis associated with the outbreak. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Andrea Tamburini, CEO of the relief group Action Against Hunger USA, about slowing food production in West Africa and the spike in food prices.
The Ebola crisis in West Africa has heavily affected the farmers in the area, and I think we're just at the beginning of a prolonged emergency crisis that we will have to face. Well, in this first phase, it's important to contain the virus, and the health aspect is key. We have already started work into the what we call the secondary effect, which mainly is food security. We have to consider that the area with very high incidence of Ebola are among the most productive regions of the three affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. The outbreak has caused serious income opportunities losses, market disruption, and restricted trade flows internally and across the border. All this has led to food price spikes in several markets.
I understand that some of them have actually abandoned their crops and gone elsewhere. So where have the farmers gone and what are they doing now?
Yes, you're right. We have already experienced a number of cases of farmers abandoning their crops. There have been three major assessments undertaken in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. And we already see almost 40% of the farmers left their crops, and they're just moving to locations which are perceived to be safer because some of those areas have been quarantined. And as the victim of the virus in number increases, farmers just abandon their land.
How has this spike in food cost affected some staple foods in West Africa?
One relevant indicator could be in Sierra Leone, the cost of rice. Rice being one of the staple products, and the price increase range between 30% to 40%. And most of the rice is imported, and so the impact, the purchasing powers on the most vulnerable household has been drastically reduced. And I think that the crisis is going to get worse.
What do you see in the 2 months ahead? You say, do you think it's going to get worse? In what way will it be worse?
September is a relevant season for the agriculture, and I think that missing this agricultural period is going to have more dramatic impact. In particular, we're thinking of affected population where the households, one of the members died from the virus, and the households are living in quarantine areas. So I think that as the number of victims increase, the manpower decreases for all those families, households, and we will have additional impact.
What type of assistance is needed in these circumstances?
In the first case, I think we need more detailed data on food security. Once we get a better detail of the situation, I think that in the first phase, we are going to focus on seeds and planting material. We're going to also work on a feeding program, in particular for children under 5 years old and pregnant women. And then as the situation slowly improves, we're going to work into cash for work intervention and other livelihoods and income generation activity in order to shore up the economy and the marketplace. For Action Against Hunger, it's also key to be able to keep on monitoring malnutrition rate, and we will intervene heavily if we see spikes into those figures.
With only 34% of the $1 billion needed to meet the challenge of the Ebola food crisis, do you think the international community needs to be more urgent?
I think so, and I think that as the data start on arriving and more assessments will be performed, it will be clear that this Ebola crisis is developing into a more complicated crisis, multifaceted crisis to be dealt with. And I think that if you look at the efforts of the United Nations agencies, it's clear that there is a lot of push from their end as well for international donors to invest more money into the crisis. The figures that we have available so far is that, as you mentioned, the food crisis will require assistance for 1.3 million people.
Andre Tamburini is CEO of the relief group Action Against Hunger USA.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
UN Children's Fund says the Great Recession of 2008 has had a devastating impact on millions of children in rich countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF's rankings of 41 wealthy countries finds 23 have failed in their duty to make life better, not worse, for their children. The report shows that 2.6 million children have sunk below the poverty line between 2008 and 2012, bringing the total number of children living in poverty in the developed world to around 76.5 million. The countries with the worst report cards are Greece and Iceland, which have been severely affected by the global financial crisis. Iceland, in particular, had a dramatic 20% increase in child poverty. In general, the report says child poverty has increased significantly in southern Europe, as well as in Croatia and the three Baltic states. But UNICEF social and economic policy specialist Yekaterina Chen says some countries have managed to improve the well-being of their children during this period of economic turbulence.
We have Chile at the top. Child poverty there actually decreased substantially by almost 9 percentage points. But the striking thing is actually that in the 15 countries at the top, child poverty has actually decreased during this period of intense economic turbulence. So that is actually quite remarkable.
Poland, Australia, Slovakia, Switzerland, Norway, and South Korea are among the top 15 countries which have reduced child poverty. UNICEF attributes this success to the strength of social protection policies. It says countries that have maintained their social safety nets have kept their children from sinking into poverty. The report says the situation of child poverty has not changed in three countries, New Zealand, the Czech Republic, and Germany. On the other hand, Chen says extreme child poverty in the United States has increased more in this economic downturn than during the recession of 1982.
This time, it's children in families where the parents are not working that are suffering particularly, and these are the children who tend to fall below the extreme poverty line. So these families are not really helped by the earned income tax credit, unlike the ones who live in poor working families. So the ones in extreme poverty, they tend to rely much more on food stamps.
Chen notes the current safety net for the poorest people in the United States is worse than in 1982. Therefore, she says even the working poor receive little help. The report also tracks the proportion of 15 to 24-year-olds who are not in education, employment, or training. It finds the recession has hit this group especially hard. It says the worst situation is found in European Union countries, where 7.5 million young people are neither working nor going to school. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Afghanistan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, is on his first official trip to China. Amid optimism back at home that increased Chinese diplomatic and economic engagement are important for bringing peace to the war-shattered country. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
President Ghani will have a busy schedule during his four-day visit to Beijing, where he will hold in-depth talks with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, on bilateral and issues of common interests. Mr. Ghani will also lead a delegation of Afghan businessmen at a meeting of Chinese investors in his bid to persuade them to develop the mining industry in his strife-torn country. Afghans believe that China's economic and diplomatic support can help their country overcome economic and security challenges after NATO troops withdraw from the country in December. Janan Musazai, Afghanistan's ambassador to neighboring Pakistan, says China is currently the largest investor in his country and bilateral cooperation has expanded in multiple areas.
Over the past 13 years, we have laid down the foundation of a very close, enduring, long-term relationship with China, and both countries are determined to further develop and strengthen these relations in the years to come, starting with President Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai's state visit to Beijing.
In an interview published Tuesday by China's state-backed Xinhua media organization, Mr. Ghani said he sees Afghanistan as a hub for regional trade and investment, and he expects relations with China will expand. China has largely avoided deepening its involvement in Afghanistan's geopolitical affairs and confined its role to an economic investor in the country's natural and energy resource sectors. It has invested nearly $7.5 billion and intends to enhance the Chinese economic footprint in Afghanistan. In the last 2 years, however, Beijing has actively sought to redefine its relations with Kabul and has appointed a special envoy to Afghanistan to further its objective. Sun Weidong, China's ambassador to neighboring Pakistan, underscores the importance of political stability for peaceful reconstruction of Afghanistan.
China believes that the national reconciliation is an inevitable course for Afghanistan to achieve national stability and prosperity.
China is hosting this year's Heart of Asia Istanbul Conference on October 31st, a gathering of regional countries around Afghanistan that discuss ways to promote Afghan national reconciliation and peaceful reconstruction. President Ghani will also attend the event. Ambassador Musazai says the conference will go a long way in promoting regional peace.
The fact that China, a key participant of the process, is hosting this ministerial conference at this historic juncture is testament to the importance and significance of this process to our collective efforts for better relations and closer cooperation in our region.
China is concerned that a security breakdown in Afghanistan after the withdrawal of international forces could fuel Uyghur separatism in its restive Xinjiang border region. The Muslim insurgency, some Chinese officials suspect, have links to Islamist militants hiding in border areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Afghan officials also believe China can use its influence with its long-term strategic partner Pakistan to persuade it to help Kabul promote reconciliation with the Taliban. Afghan officials have long believed the Taliban directs its insurgency in Afghanistan from safe havens in Pakistan. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Tibetan Prime Minister in exile Lobsang Sangye has attended the ceremony marking the founding of the non-governmental organization Tibet Charity in India's northern town of Dharamsala. Hundreds of Tibetans and supporters gathered at Tibetan Institute of Performing Arts to celebrate the event, wherein leaders and activists delivered speeches and various artists performed cultural activities. Sangye hailed the efforts of those involved with the charitable organization.
Despite all the challenges you all have sustained for 10 years, this is a remarkable achievement. You know, in Buddhism, we all are advised by Solness Dalai Lama to have a kind heart. But to have a kind heart and do kind things is quite different.
Tibet Charity is based in Dharamsala, which has been the global headquarters of Tibetan exile since 1959. Many settled there after walking for weeks across the Tibetan plateau. A programming note for you. Starting November 3rd, a Monday, this edition of International Edition will be moved one half hour earlier to 12:05 Universal Time. We hope you can join us then, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On October 28, 1420, Beijing was officially designated the capital of the Ming Dynasty on the same year that the Forbidden City, the seat of government, was completed. In 1886, the Statue of Liberty was dedicated in New York Harbor, given to the United States by France in recognition of the friendship established during the American Revolution. The Statue of Liberty was the first sight many immigrants saw as they arrived in their new home, and has grown to symbolize freedom and democracy. On this day in 1919, the U.S. Congress passed the Volstead Act. The law provided for the enforcement against the constitutionally prohibited manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcoholic beverages. The effort was in vain, however, as the enforcement of the law not only failed to prevent the distribution and consumption of alcoholic beverages, but spawned the rapid growth of organized crime. The amendment to the Constitution that prohibited alcoholic beverages was repealed in 1933. On this day in 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis came to an end as Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev agreed to remove Russian missiles from Cuba in exchange for a promise from the United States to respect Cuba's territorial sovereignty. On this day in 1956, 20-year-old Elvis Presley was in the middle of a run of hit records. After topping the charts for 11 weeks with Don't Be Cruel, Presley would succeed himself for another 5 weeks with this famous ballad.
Love me tender.
Love me tender wasn't Presley's biggest hit of 1956. That title went to Heartbreak Hotel. Altogether, Elvis had 6 number one songs during the year. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A report on alleged human rights abuses by Congolese security forces has spurred a confrontation between the government there and the United Nations. The United States has expressed deep concern over the decision of the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo to expel the UN's top human rights official over his findings, and strongly urges officials to reverse the decision. Scott Campbell, director of the UN Joint Human Rights Office, was asked to leave the country on October 17th, following the release of a UN investigative report into actions by Congolese security forces during a police operation in Kinshasa late last year. According to the report, published on October 15th, the Congolese National Police had committed summary and extrajudicial executions of 9 persons, including one minor, and forced disappearances of 32 persons during what was called Operation Lekofi between November 15, 2013 and February 15, 2014. Congolese officials have denied the charges, saying Campbell deserved to be expelled because the report was full of lies. The United Nations plays an important role in contributing to the security and well-being of the Congolese people, including through the UN peacekeeping mission there, MONUSCO, its humanitarian operations, and its support for good governance, democracy, and human rights. MONUSCO is specifically mandated by the UN Security Council to prepare regular reports on the status of human rights in the DRC. The United States reaffirms its strong support for the work of the UN and its commitment to fight against impunity for violations of human rights. We urge the Congolese government to investigate the allegations of extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances by some members of its security forces and to hold those responsible to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.